Welcome to The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. I'm Laurel Nemi, your host for The Wildlife, and also author of Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensic Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. Today on The Wildlife, I'll talk with Ray Victorine, director of the Wildlife Conservation Society's Conservation Finance Program. We'll talk about how economic incentives can promote wildlife conservation and hear about a number of concrete examples, such as wildlife-friendly certification and what's known as the RED program for reducing emissions from deforestation and forest degradation in developing countries. Ray heads the Wildlife Conservation Society's, or WCS's, global efforts to develop sustainable financing opportunities that explore market mechanisms to meet conservation objectives and contribute to sustainable development in global areas of biodiversity importance. Additionally, he leads WCS's initiatives to engage with companies and governments in an effort to balance conservation and development interests through mitigating and compensating for impacts. He is actively involved in the emerging markets for ecosystem services, including work on RED, biodiversity offsets and water, as well as exploring development of other innovative financial mechanisms for conservation. For instance, he is president of the board of the Wildlife Friendly Enterprise Network. Ray has contributed to the design and development of a variety of endowment funds and conservation funding institutions around the world, including creation of the first land trust in East Africa. His PhD studies were in economics and geography, and he also holds a master's degree in agricultural economics, emphasizing natural resources and with a research focus on water resources management. When we spoke recently, I asked Ray how he first got interested in conservation finance.
Well, I have to go back a while. I had been sort of involved with various people who began to explore the possibility of setting up long-term funding mechanisms for conservation and looking at opportunities such as trust funds, for example, or endowment funds where some donors were interested in putting funding, large pieces of funding aside that would then be invested in allowing the opportunity for these institutions to spend money on conservation activities from the income they earn from their investments. So I started working on those kinds of activities, as well as exploring different sort of market-based activities to generate support for conservation, both support and money for conservation. And so it's been an area that I've been focused on for quite some time, probably since the mid to late 80s.
Has the field evolved, and what are really the components of conservation finance? Because you were talking about something, an investment that basically provides long-term funding over a long period of time that's sustainable.
Evolution, actually. Many of us sort of began working on issues of conservation finance. One of the areas that was of interest was beginning to set up these trust funds, financing mechanisms. Part of those were created through an initiative back in the 80s to do debt forgiveness by the United States to Latin America specifically. So there were a lot of opportunities to have debt forgiven and using that forgiveness to create funds for investing in biodiversity conservation. So a lot of the effort that when we started was looking at how do you create these funds? How do you put funds together that can manage money, can be set up as potential grant-making institutions or other funding institutions that weren't necessarily controlled by government, had a board that was independent but maybe involved government that included other stakeholders so that you had a mix of people involved in the decision-making in terms of how the money was used, but coordinating very carefully and closely with, government plans with their strategies on the biodiversity conservation. So I think that's how it began, and there's been a lot of attention, a lot of tools developed to help develop trust funds, and donors are still very interested in providing funding for trust funds. In fact, in the last over the last 4 years, we've been putting together an analysis looking at the returns from the investments of trust funds, which shows that pretty much the funds have done a very good job of sort of taking a prudent approach to their investments, you know, kind of balancing, doing pretty well balancing their risk with their growth as they try to grow their capital and meet their needs and to expand into other areas, too, that may be possible. For example, some of these funds now have 10, 12, 15, 20 years of operations, and they have a lot of experience in managing resources. So, you know, you've heard a lot about the potential for things like RED, you know, the reduced emissions from deforestation and degradation, where people could reduce deforestation and have emission reduction credits that would then be sold. Well, as those funds come into these countries from those sales, some of these trust funds are really well established and could be play important roles in terms of managing those resources. So that's one way that some of these trust funds may evolve. But there's been lots of other evolution in terms of looking at different market mechanisms that could be applied for conservation finance, innovative approaches, figuring out ways that we can use money and resources to create incentives for conservation.
So it's really all about getting people to act in their own self-interest and creating incentives so that when they do act in their self-interest, they're doing it in a way that's appropriate or that helps biodiversity and helps wildlife and helps habitat.
That's right. I mean, you could, you know, if, for example, if you had, well, let me give you an example. We have the Wildlife Conservation Society has a project in Zambia, and the director there, Dale Lewis, had been trying really, really hard to figure out successful approaches for conservation, and it's been challenging. And so he stumbled on an idea where he sort of linked the conservation to people's strong needs in terms of their livelihoods as far as agriculturalists. He basically created a co-op for, you know, a cooperative structure where to work with farmers, and they're doing totally organic agriculture. They changed over from more traditional to an organic production. The co-op has been working very, very hard to market the products. And so to join the co-op, you have to agree that as part of your commitment is that you won't be hunting animals, that you'll be helping to maintain the habitat for wildlife and to manage for the maintenance of the ecosystem services. Well, lo and behold, the prices that farmers are getting are higher for their products. Through their marketing mechanism, people are really happy because they're getting paid quickly and they're getting paid a better price. And in exchange for collecting snares and for managing the land, probably doing some fencing, putting in place procedures that are better for the management of wildlife and no longer hunting, they've been able to do monitoring and indicate that wildlife populations are increasing. But at the same time, the conflicts that would drive people to hunt or to kill animals is decreasing. Or it's less important because people know how to deal with that conflict and at the same time have access to markets as part of this process that they're involved with as in with the co-op. So there you go, is that you have a direct relationship between higher incomes better livelihoods, and improved management of natural resources.
So if something like an elephant were to trample crops in this co-op, I presume, knowing the region in Zambia, anyway, that would probably be a problem previously. Is it, first of all, am I right about that? Is that the case? And how would conflicts be handled?
Well, the idea, there are always different mechanisms. One is that, as I mentioned earlier, you could do some fencing that would help keep out elephants. There are, within the co-op, you could easily set up maybe insurance and compensation schemes, because sometimes people will do their best efforts to keep animals out. That, an elephant comes in your garden, it makes a big mess. I mean, here where I live, we worry about deer coming in and eating our plants, which an elephant does much more damage. And, so there's, there are lots of insurance schemes and compensation schemes that have been developed for people who participate in these co-ops. Also, one of the products that, one of the programs and a product has come out of that is something called Elephant Pepper. And Elephant Pepper was developed through some research, another WCS researcher who was working with elephants in Zimbabwe at the time. And he came up with an interesting finding that elephants really, really hate chili.
They just haven't developed that taste for spicy foods.
They don't like hot food. They wouldn't do very well in an Indian restaurant, I guess. But they really don't. And so what he was able to do was to extract through the juices of the chili peppers, and he would mix it with like grease. And really devise these very, very flimsy, and they were quite flimsy fences, maybe with some sticks and some rope that went around these sticks, and would coat them with this grease and chili peppers. Well, the elephants would come along and touch this stuff and just be really annoyed. Be really upset, but stay away. They didn't like it. And so all of a sudden, farmers realized they had a very simple technology that they could use around their farms to keep the elephants out. So basically, you had an innovation that was simple, discovered through some good research, and that could be applied and result in significant savings, both in terms of losses that the farmers would suffer from these animals, and also the losses that would occur from wildlife because people were so angry and would retaliate against the animals. Well, they no longer had to do that.
So did the farmers start growing the peppers themselves?
Well, yeah, during that one project, and this is happening, expanding, where the group was set up as a company was then formed that was then growing these peppers, had some export contracts, whereas selling the peppers, so people actually had jobs farming to cultivate the chili peppers, and then part of the peppers were also being used to as a sort of contribution to the foundation, then so that for training of farmers to use them in their garden to reduce the conflict and entry of elephants into their gardens. And then they made they developed this little sauce called elephant pepper sauce. Well, there are multiple sauces that are chili that are now exported from Southern Africa and quite good, mixed with chilies with baobab and some more exotic type spices to create a really nice product.
If someone here in the States wanted to support farmers in Southern Africa, could they find elephant pepper here in the States? Does that really help the farmer in Zimbabwe to buy a product like elephant pepper?
It does. I mean, it as sales grow, that money goes back to the Elephant Pepper Foundation, which is then invested in research and in expansion of the technology so that farmers are able to protect their crops. So there's a, you know, there's a direct link there in terms of contributing money that will then be invested in the fields of Zambia or Mozambique or Zimbabwe, where the programs operate.
Now, you had mentioned that that was in part developed with help from WCS. Is that, I wanted to get back to the WCS's conservation finance program, and are programs like that part of it?
The program is really multifaceted. As I said, part of it is, you know, we've worked with various donors and governments to help set up long-term funds for conservation. Now, interestingly, and this is sort of like, you know, this conservation finance stuff isn't so new. Back in the 70s, we had some researchers who were working with mountain gorillas and began the initial tourism with mountain gorillas that is now quite popular in Rwanda and Uganda and Eastern DRC. So now, for example, if you go to Uganda, just to use an example, clear example, in a country where a good portion of the national park system is now covered as a result of tourism dollars coming into the country from visits to mountain gorillas as part of an ecotourism project. I think right now tourists pay $500 each to spend an hour with a group of mountain gorillas. I think now there's like six or seven groups of gorillas that can be visited, and eight people a day. And oftentimes most days those spots are filled. So there's significant revenue coming in from something like ecotourism, which is another conservation financing approach. We have, you know, for example, in Tanzania, again, on the tourism side, sometimes it's sort of looking at what kind of mechanisms can you find. There were these tour operators who wanted to make sure that elephants could be visited during the both dry season and rainy season. And during the wet season, the elephants would move off into private land.
And where was this?
This is in Tanzania.
Okay.
And so they would move into private land. So this is land that people were thinking about having to doing for agriculture. So if they did more agriculture in that region, then those areas might be closed off for elephant migration, which wouldn't be great for the elephants, but it also wouldn't be good for the tour operators who were used to taking their clients to visit the elephants. So basically, in that case, there was discussions, and the conservationists were active in helping to broker a deal where the tour operators actually pay the farmers to maintain their land open and allow them to take the tourists. And they pay them enough money that they're equally happy to have that happen than they are earning money from agriculture. So they manage their land so that there's a benefit to the elephants. So that's an example of where tourism is at play. We've mentioned this, you know, this agricultural connection. We also have, you know, we have an interesting, I think you had a chance to talk to Julie Stein about Wildlife Friendly. And one of the things that, you know, we're a member of that Wildlife Friendly Enterprise Network and helped get that started, because we think there are lots of connections that and lots of opportunity for creating demand for products. For example, I was telling you about the Zambia case where one of the things that people were doing as part of their commitment to conservation was collecting snares. Well, a lot of the snares have been collected, and one of the ideas is that what they've done is using the wire as a base for the creation of jewelry and selling that as an extra income for women's groups. So, again, linked to conservation in a way, or linked to stopping poaching, but also then a product comes from that. And so basically, you know, what conservation finance is all about is there are a couple things I would say. Is that, you know, can we create the incentives for people to choose a land management approach which is more sustainable?
And so what are some of those incentives?
And so what are those incentives? You know, it could be that you're paying contracts for people to manage their forests in a certain way, like Costa Rica does. You know, they pay farmers to manage their forests and their watersheds so that there's better water flow, So there's a direct payment coming from the government to the land managers to ensure that downstream there's water flow and there's not sedimentation. So there's a quality issue and a quantity issue.
And how do they get that money?
Well, they have a tax on automobiles, and that then feeds into their system to make these payments. So the idea is to find a source of revenue or source of income that can get the system going. If you can link it to a market and you have a good product, then hopefully that market will be sustainable and will generate sufficient income. You know, one of the wildlife-friendly products that programs that we have, for example, in Madagascar, works with small-scale farmers to produce essential oils. And they do it in a way that they're no longer burning forest, they're managing the forest, they're managing it for wildlife and for ecosystem services. And as long as they do that, they're able to harvest plants and produce oils that are then right now sold in Europe. So that's another link right there in terms of management. In terms of conservation finance, we're looking at different mechanisms.
What kind of mechanisms?
One of them, I think I briefly mentioned, was, you know, the potential markets for carbon. I know it's kind of a controversial issue. It's one that hasn't been resolved. But, you know, for example, in Madagascar WCS, we started a project back in 2004 to begin sort of dabbling in this carbon market, whatever it was going to be at the time, because, you know, the rules have kept changing, and, you know, but we decided, well, this seems like it'd be a very interesting, an interesting conservation finance approach.
So what have you been doing?
So we've been sort of developing that project since 2004. And interestingly, we just did a study over the last 5 years to look at what we expected the rate of deforestation would have been, looked at how we might be able to reduce that deforestation. And after 5 years, found out that we actually exceeded our expectations. Deforestation rates are much lower than we thought, than even expected. And we haven't really had many carbon payments. We've had some voluntary sales, about 140,000 tons over the from 2004 until today. So it's been, we've been able to put some of that funding in, but we've also been working with a local foundation in Madagascar to get some funding to invest in permaculture, invest in water management, and also the incentive for a lot of people was new agreements with the government, where not only would you have a protected area, but you'd also have forest land that would be turned over to community level management, which was a high priority for people in terms of having access to the resources. So the combination of this investment and the change in legal status of the land created the incentives to manage the forest more sustainably. And we hope that once we, if we're able to take advantage of the carbon market and the development of this new market, we think we can raise significant money and really stimulate better management of the forests in Madagascar and, well, around the world.
There's a number of things I wanted to follow up on and
sure.
Get more in depth in. One of which is, since we were just talking about deforestation, and given that forests are just incredible habitats for wildlife and provide ecosystem services, and you had mentioned earlier the RED program, the reducing emissions from deforestation and forest degradation. Can you describe how RED works? What are the criteria for RED programs? And are there examples that can show, you know, how you reduce deforestation and have these positive effects on local people and biodiversity?
How long is your show?
Yeah. In 5 minutes or less. No, I'm just kidding. We have time.
Sorry, I mean it is complicated, and
I think, you know, from the outside, this is one of the issues, is that, I mean, in my mind, is it's very confusing even for people who are very interested and keep up with it. How does it work, and how can a normal person support it? Also,
I'll do my best to explain it, because in reality, you know, the whole carbon sort of cap and trade issue began with the Kyoto Protocol, and as part of that agreement, countries set different levels of emissions, and it was a cap, and then countries could invest in other projects somewhere else to help reduce their emissions, sort of offsetting those emissions somewhere. But forestry wasn't involved. People thought forestry was going to be too complicated, that it was not something that would be easy to operate, and people scratched their heads and said, well, wait a minute, you know, probably 20% of all emissions are caused by burning of forest or changing land use changes. So if we don't address land use change, we will, you know, we're going to miss a whole lot of opportunity in terms of reducing emissions. So that's where this concept of RED was born, you know, that can we reduce our emissions from this deforestation and land degradation, and if so, how do we do that? And it got really complicated because, well, if you stop some deforestation here, will it move somewhere else? You know, how permanent is it, for example, if you're working and you've reduced it for 10 years and all of a sudden there's a huge forest fire, would you have these losses? So there are lots of complications involved that have led to long, long discussion and analysis of how do you actually set up the baselines to measure the level of forest and the losses. So as a result, we're still sort of in the process of working it out in terms of how RED gets included in global agreements. As you know, right now, after the meetings in Copenhagen, there is right now no sort of follow-on to Kyoto that's been agreed. So how this all will fit into a market is uncertain. But there has been a voluntary market for carbon. That is, from companies who are interested in reducing their carbon footprint. And there have been projects that have been designed to reduce deforestation. And basic argument around it is that there are methodologies in place to assess what's going on in the country. What's causing deforestation and what's the rate of deforestation? And then identifying actions that could go forward, whether they're policies or specific investments that need to go forward to reduce that rate of deforestation. So if you thought in 10 years you were going to lose 100 hectares of forest, but basically you could put in place efforts to maybe you lose only 20 hectares of forest, or maybe you lose 30 hectares of forest, that residual part that you didn't lose because of your management techniques stores quite a bit of carbon, and that's the avoided losses that you would then be able to generate, that you would then be able to market, because you have basically reduced the rate of deforestation. By reducing the rate of deforestation, less carbon dioxide goes into the atmosphere. So those are what we call emission reductions, and those are the emission reductions that are sold in the market. And as I said, have been sold on the voluntary market, because that's really the only market that's operating today for RED. The whole system is getting much more sophisticated. Many of the projects that are going forward to be sold in RED meet principles of called the voluntary carbon standard. It's a standard that's been established to look at and create the imprimatur in terms of what's a legitimate carbon credit, and methodologies have been developed, scientifically reviewed through quite a rigorous process, and those methodologies are then applied to projects to demonstrate that, yes, these projects are actually contributing emission reductions. Combined with the voluntary carbon standard, there's another standard called the Climate Community and Biodiversity Standard, and that standard provides others extra confirmation that your project is benefiting communities and also protecting biodiversity. So a lot of projects all the projects that we at WCS do will all be validated under voluntary carbon standard, as well as the Climate Community and Biodiversity Standard.
Who validates them?
Auditors, third-party auditors, sort of like certification. So these auditors will have been approved by the board of the VCS as competent to be able to go ahead and judge projects according to the established standards.
So that third-party auditing is really critical so that you know that you're getting what you're paying for, sort of.
Well, yeah, basically, you know, of course, people could say, well, we thought AIG was doing that in the financial markets, and look what happened. So, I mean, there's always going to be skepticism, but the system is structured in such a way that there is a validation. So the project is basically validated and said this was designed and has been structured in accordance with these rigorous guidelines. So the project will go forward. And say, let's say it operates for 3 years. So then the auditors would come in and say, oh, okay, according to this project, it said that it would reduce deforestation by this much and it would generate this many credits. We've gone, we've done our GIS, you know, we've done our spatial analysis, we've done in the field, and we can verify that indeed these many credits have been generated, and then the credits are sold. So there's a two-pronged process. One is the validation that it's been designed and structured appropriately according to the standard, and then two, that it actually delivered the those emissions. Those have been, that they've been verified.
So somebody couldn't. So that process avoids the situation where you say, oh, there's going to be 100 hectares of damage, you know, of deforestation. That's what I predict. When really 50 is more like it.
That's right. Yeah. So they'll go, they'll say, right, well, no, they said that they were going to generate, yeah, cut down, there would be a lot less, this much lost, and this many credits, when in fact there was more loss and fewer credits, so we can only verify this much. Or it could be the vice versa, as the case that we're seeing in our project in Madagascar, where we were we reduced deforestation way below than what we thought was even possible.
And that was the program that you were talking about earlier, is that right?
Right, the main Makura forest in Madagascar, yeah.
Because I was just about to ask you if you could describe some of the other activities that were also supported by RED. And you talked about the Makura Forest Protected Area, but I was wondering also about the Albertine Rift Program in the Democratic Republic of Congo or others that you might be able to describe.
There are various projects that are sort of underway, under design around the world. Some are further along than others. What is true is that the VCS, in terms of approving its methodologies, it's still a process that's going forward. There have been no, I have to be careful when I say if there's no, because things are changing, but there's one methodology that I think now is approved for RED. Some others are getting close. The process has taken quite a long time because of the rigor, the analysis that's gone into ensuring that these methodologies are scientifically defensible. So right now, for example, if we look at the Makura project, we designed that project according to the best available science back in 2004. So even though it's been operating since 2004, has actually reduced the emissions and reduced deforestation, we still don't have a project that's validated under VCS because the methodology that...
And just as a reminder, VCS stands for...
The Voluntary Carbon Standards. We're using the Voluntary Carbon Standard, and the methodology that has been submitted, that we use, that has been submitted to the Voluntary Carbon Standard Board, has still not been approved. It's in the process of going through the it's going through the approval process now. So for that reason, we don't have a validated project. The credits that we've been able to market have been people who wanted to, as I say, offset their carbon footprint and have faith that the project will be validated and that that these are legitimate credits. It's based on more reputation. And we know they're legitimate, and they will then, once we get the validation, and since we've been operating for 5 years, we'll do a validation and a verification for those first 5 years, and then all those credits will put on a registry and accounted for. But there have been, you know, most of the projects operating now in the RED stance have either no validation, or they've gone through the Climate, Community, and Biodiversity Standard, which indicates that they've been designed with biodiversity and social issues in mind, but still awaiting the carbon standard so that they can validate against that those carbon benefits. Does that make sense? Is that clear?
It does. I'm wondering, so what happens after it has that validation? Are the prices higher for the carbon credits that are generated, or is that when you can sell them?
Well, right now, before the flop at Copenhagen, there was the people were anticipating the growth in the market. And so people were buying credits in anticipation that the good projects would be getting their validation. Now we're seeing some interest, but much more a little bit more caution in the market, where people are saying, well, we really like your project, but we're going to wait until you have your validation. So, and the only thing holding up the validation is, I say, the methodology is being approved.
And then who approves the methodology?
The board, well, it's there's a whole advisory, scientific advisory board, technical advisory committee of this voluntary carbon standard, which is an independent body, which has been established to develop these procedures for project-based forest carbon projects.
And then in some ways it sounds similar to what you were talking about with the Wildlife Friendly Enterprise Network. And I wanted to go back to that because in some ways maybe that's concrete and can also help in the idea of RED, is to talk about that network and what a wildlife friendly product is. And in essence, that's a type of certification for a product that's friendly to wildlife.
That's right. We came up with the idea of, there's lots of certifications out there. And at a meeting we held, we discussed the idea of, there really isn't much out there that really demonstrates that a product is benefiting habitat and wildlife. So we began looking at this to see if there was a possibility of if there would be interest in the development of some kind of mark or certification that would recognize wildlife-friendly producers. That is, people who were working hard in their production processes to ensure that wildlife were protected, were not being hunted, were not being killed in the process, that habitats that were beneficial for wildlife were being protected as part of the commit to the process of developing the product, for example. So we decided to launch this and to see what kind of A, interest there would be, and B, if there was sort of market interest. Were consumers interested in it? Were some of sort of producers interested in getting products that could be the sourcing products that could be considered wildlife friendly? And it's a relatively new, I think we basically launched in like 2007 or 8, and so end of 2007, early 2008. So it's only been a couple of years, and so we're going through the process of identifying products, going through certification mechanisms, and trying to get products out there to test out the market. It's pretty much a voluntary approach right now. We're relatively small. We are very small, actually, and it's pretty rigorous. And we realize that as a result of the rigor of the standard, it's going to be pretty interesting in terms of finding out which products will actually be able to qualify. So we're in the process of reviewing that whole process and looking for a variety of new products to bring into the market and to start exploring if this has any resonance.
Some of the products that you mentioned earlier, the elephant pepper, is something that has been certified?
Yes, it has. Well, elephant pepper, we have several products. We have elephant pepper, and then the products that are produced by this project Komako in Zambia, most of those products are food-based products and are sold in local markets. There's some potential for regional exports, certification, and then export to regional markets like in South Africa. We have another product, which is a rice product, which is called Ibis rice, and it's produced by farmers who are protecting habitat of the ibis, and that rice is actually sold at a bit of a premium to local restaurants. It's right near the Angkor Wat area, so there are a lot of tourists who come in to look, do birding, and local hotels and restaurants are carrying this certified ibis rice, and sort of promoting this conservation theme. And so that's been very popular with farmers. We have an alpaca project in Ecuador where the management of the herds is done in such a way to avoid conflict with Andean bear, for example.
How do they manage the herds differently?
Well, you can, you know, you could do corralling. You could they do some corralling and managing of their herd so that they're not exposed primarily, mostly to the bears at night. So by practicing better husbandry, they're able to avoid the predation. And they're also working with other farmers to get them to adopt better practices. So the idea would be to create even more opportunities under this wildlife-friendly brand for farmers who are undertaking these practices. And there are other products that are out there now. We have some products in Kenya through Ann Kent Taylor. And so a lot of the products are things like jewelry, some food products, some clothing. We have some paper coming out of Nepal, essential oils out of Madagascar. So there are quite a variety of different products. Some are inputs and some are final products.
And then if someone is interested in this, you know, how does the certification work? What is the process for that if someone has a project where they would like to get some benefit?
Well, they could write to, you know, go on wildlifefriendly.org and it would write to us and submit their proposal. We have a proposal in, a brand new proposal in now for someone who's doing wild silk in Madagascar. So it's not been certified, but it's a proposal that's come in. It's kind of interesting, and we're looking at that now. I should say that, you know, right now Wildlife Friendly is a second-party certification. What I mean by that is that we in the network review the programs, we certify them, we use our connections in the countries where we work to verify that the product is what it is and the practices are what they are, and then we have requirements for monitoring, and then we have follow-up on the monitoring every year to make sure that there's compliance. It's not third-party, that is, we don't have external auditors. And this is something we made an active decision about because, one, as you bring in auditors, it raises the price of monitoring and compliance to the producer. And if there's no benefit, if there's no, if we can't guarantee higher prices, then it's kind of hard to get people to, or convince them to pay something when their margins may not be super high anyway. So we're keeping it at the time, for the time being, as a second party certification, but trying to keep it as rigorous as we can through our network. That's another of our constraints. We don't have a zillion products that we're bringing out that would then be audited by different groups.
So in other words, the price premium for having something that's certified wildlife friendly, it's still falling out right now because the brand is new and there may be a premium, but you don't know how much. So you want to reduce costs, basically, so you don't have to pay extra for some a premium price that you may or may not get.
That's right. And one of the things that we've been exploring is, for example, if we work with a product that is certified by some other entity, could we have that entity also do a check of the monitoring and do some checks that would then say, okay, then we can give it a third party. So we're exploring different options so that we can minimize the cost to the producer while still guaranteeing the consumer that what they're getting is a wildlife-friendly product.
You were mentioning some ecotourism-type opportunities at the beginning of our conversation, and I'm wondering how, you know, there's a huge market for ecotourism, and how can someone know that it really is helping the animals that they're there to see? I've heard a lot of cases of, you know, people going scuba diving and snorkeling and wanting to save sea turtles, and then in the shops at the hotel, there's sea turtle products and so on and so forth. So is that something, you know, how can someone know and is wildlife friendly thinking about certifying tourist type practices?
You know, it's an idea that we've talked about. Honestly, I think it'll be a lot of work. We have to make sure that we could differentiate us, because there's so many little sustainable tourism marks. So many different mechanisms are used for tourism. However, I'd be interested to even your listeners, their ideas if this is something they would find very useful, because I have the sense that it would be that people would like to know that the operator that they're using, the hotel where they're staying, the safari leader, what have you, is actually committed to that kind of behavior. I remember visiting and talking with wilderness safaris and their Botswana operations. You know, one of the things that they had done was buy up all the hunting concessions near their lodges, and so they held all the hunting concessions, and they were paying the government for those concessions, but they weren't hunting. They were actually protecting those lands against hunting for the benefit of their tourism, which was great. So the demand for their product and the demand for tourism in Botswana was such that they were able to really guarantee that the wildlife was protected. And there's a commitment to that. So I think that there are groups and organizations that could be certified as wildlife friendly. I mean, I don't know if we dug deep enough, we would say that they were certifiable. I'm just saying that was an example that I saw that I thought, well, that's good. That's really working.
So what would it take to certify tourist ventures? Because I presume that's extremely challenging.
Well, again, you know, having just begun thinking about it and not really knowing all the ins and outs of the tourist industry, I think we'd have to, you couldn't necessarily say this company is wildlife friendly. You might say that this company's product in such and such a place is wildlife friendly. Because, you know, if you're going to look at a whole company, you'd have to look at every site they operated. What if a tour operator, you know, goes to three countries, and two of those countries, they have sites where there really are good management of wildlife-friendly, you know, there's good wildlife-friendly management of those enterprises. But what if in the third country there aren't none at all, but the operator wants to be wildlife-friendly certified? Well, you could say he's two-thirds certified because two of the three places he goes or she goes. You know, so it gets a little tricky, you know, so we'd have to figure out different kind of mechanisms and follow up on those and analyze those. So, it would, given our size and given our system, we found it a little bit daunting. Having said that, the Kamako project in Zambia, which the products have been certified, runs what they call bush camps, and they bring tourists in. But we have no problem being able to certify those bush camps as wildlife-friendly because it's part of a whole wildlife-friendly system. The whole existence of the operation, of the economics of that system is based on management of wildlife in an appropriate manner. I told you about the Ibis Rice Project in Cambodia. Well, they also run a tourism lodge. Again, the whole system is linked to the protection of these ibis. And the money from the tourism comes in and helps, you know, pay for better land management, and it's all integrated. So those are the kind of tourist operations we can actually certify pretty easily. And I think we will expand on tourism. I think it's something that's certainly in our sort of sights to do that. And I think if we could, you know, one of the things that we just need to do a better job at is actually raising some resources, if we could get some donor assistance, where we could actually develop that standard appropriately and start testing it out and putting it in place, then I think we could move in that direction.
Do you see any other conservation finance challenges, or what might the future bring in this area?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, if you look at our growing, you know, consumption for all sorts of products, you know, look at electronics, we look at, you know, our demand for fuels and all. You know, I did some, we looked at, you know, some numbers, and the projected investment in hydrocarbons and mining in the world between now and 2030 is about $30
trillion. $30
trillion. Yeah, that's with 90s. And that's a whole lot more zeros than that are coming in terms of, you know, conservation money. And that means, you know, investments everywhere, opening up new areas in the Amazon, investments in all throughout Africa. We're seeing it, you know, the DRC, for example.
That's Democratic Republic of the Congo.
They're looking at huge growth, mostly from, you know, mining and hydrocarbons. So that means tremendous impact on biodiversity, on water resources. And it's pretty hard to argue that to governments that where there's lots of poverty, that should go forward. So some of our options may be to begin to look at, well, how do we work with governments and companies to really undertake best practices, avoiding those impacts where they can be avoided, you know, mitigating to the extent possible, but there's still going to be huge impact. So what kind of compensation schemes can we have? Can we say, okay, well, you've created this kind of destruction of resources, and we can measure what those losses are, and so there should be some kind of gains and financing of those gains through maybe investments in new protected areas or new areas that are managed more sustainably, or contracts with communities over, you know, for 30 years or so, where as long as these activities are going forward. And that could create new resources. But, you know, sure, we're not going to, as I said, I don't think we're going to stop it, but if we can come up with mechanisms that can generate more resources, and we do proper planning so that we know there are areas where, you know, companies shouldn't go. There maybe shouldn't be development. Other areas where, well, we know it's going to happen, and okay, if it's going to happen, then we have to figure out how we balance against those losses. So those are some of the challenges I see coming into the future.
Well, I'm looking forward to having another conversation at a future time.
All right, great.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation about innovative approaches for financing wildlife conservation with Ray Victorine, director of the Wildlife Conservation Society's Conservation Finance Program.
Archived episodes of The Wildlife are available on iTunes, at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And, of course, if you have comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnemi.com.
The Wildlife is generously underwritten by the Lake Champlain Land Trust, a nonprofit organization permanently conserving the lands, lakeshore, critical wildlife habitats, and natural areas of Lake Champlain. More information is available online at lclt.org. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, in Burlington, Vermont.